The time now is 3 p.m. Stay tuned for Black Star News with Milton Alamadi. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Sisters and brothers, welcome to Black Star News Show on WBAI New York 99.5 FM radio, also streaming on WBAI.org. I am your host, Milton Alamadi, and today we have a good Pan-African brother, our guest, Professor Naka Lagoke. He's with the Department of History, Political Science, and Philosophy at Lincoln University, a proud HBCU professor. And Lincoln, by the way, has two famous African graduates, the late Kwame Nkrumah and the late Nnamdi Azikiwe. Both were leaders, respectively, of their countries after independence, Ghana and Nigeria. Welcome to Black Star News Show, Professor Lagoke.
Yeah, thank you very much, Milton, for the opportunity.
Okay, excellent. There's a lot of ground to cover. Why don't we start with South Africa? We've discussed it on this show, but I'm very interested in also getting your perspective, because what I like about your presentations is that you work on sort of a format so that people can understand that a lot of these crisis points that we see are interconnected. There's something that is common amongst all these countries. And basically, these are all peripheral countries that are dominated, controlled, exploited by the center. So I think if we take that approach, it makes it easier for listeners to understand the crises in these countries rather than just dealing with them with an episodic approach. Oh, look what's happening in this country today. Look what's happening there. They're not random. So why don't we take that approach and start with South Africa, for example? It's been in the news since July the 7th with the arrest of Jacob Zuma, former President Zuma. And then, of course, we saw the eruption, the uprisings, occasioned with the lootings as well. But we don't want the CNN or the BBC perspective here on WBAI. So give us a breakdown of what's really going on in South Africa.
Thank you very much. You know, we will try to, you know, to give, to shed like a different light on some of the events. South Africa, for those who are listening to us, the current president of South Africa is Cyril Ramaphosa.
Correct.
He's naturally like the leader of the African National Congress, the political party created in 1912, Nelson Mandela's party, and who was going to become the first black president of South Africa on after the election held on April 27, 1994. So Nelson Mandela put into place a process of transitional justice through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And then the Europeans who settled in South Africa when the Cape Colony was created in 1652, and who for more than 300 years ruled over South Africa and exploited blacks and minorities, somehow were given the opportunity, to be part of the process, and South Africa avoided bloodshed. Now called the Rainbow Nation, and then that was based on the Ubuntu philosophy, which is humanness, promoted by the South African elite, then South Africa became like that, you know, that rising star, like in terms of politics and democracy. And then many people across the globe were very happy and proud, even though Nelson Mandela generation could not fix in a few years, you know, the ills and the stigma of racial subjugation and racial segregation in South Africa. Now, even when Mandela was there, we saw that there was already a battle. And then this is how Thabo Mbeki, with the support of some elders, became the successor of Nelson Mandela. And then later on, Thabo Mbeki and then Ramaphosa were like in conflict. Thabo Mbeki won, became the leader. And then with the support of Jacob Zuma, who was going to become his vice president when Mandela like left power. So with Zuma and Thabo, there was a big issue about Zuma being involved in some bribery or some financial scandals. And then so this continued till now. And then after his term in power, Zuma has to face the justice system in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Now, after giving that background, my position is that even though, this is what I'm thinking, even though Zuma may have done or did things that were not correct, even though he was not seen as a moral figure, even though he was involved, if it was proven that he was involved in all those financial scandals, I think that the way the South African leaders, under the leadership of Cyril Ramaphosa, they're conducting that trial, I think that it is not good for the stability of the nation. Because the Zulus in South Africa, and Thabo Mbeki is Xhosa, Mandela is Xhosa, Zuma represents, the Zulu in South Africa represent 22% of the population. And then when, during the transition, there was a big issue in South Africa between the ANC and then the Inkatha, the party led by Buthelezi, the leader of the Zulu. There was that tension between the Xhosa and the Zulu, even though both of them are a part of the Igunu tribes or Igunu ethnic groups in South Africa. So for me, and also there's an issue with what people call that Zulu nationalism. They wanted to secede from the South African nation. And now when people see that the system is going after Zuma, true or false, they think that it is an expression of the Zulu persecution or the Zulu prosecution. And for me, this could have been resolved in a political manner. And for the sake of the stability of South Africa, then, because when you want to do everything by the law, then you may jeopardize the stability of the nation, of the South African nation. So this is my take on that. I can even go further and say, you know what? So what is happening to all those people who are looting this economy of South Africa, or those Afrikaners, or those who do not want, who are continuing the exploitation of South Africa? How many of them have been taken to prison? And for Zuma to be humiliated like that, I think that even though the people could have the evidence that, you know, he has done everything that they're saying, even though he refused to go to court, they could have found a different way to resolve the issue. Because during the Truth and Reconciliation process, Peter Botha, the president of South Africa, of the National Party, refused to go before the Truth and Reconciliation platform. But what happened to him? Nothing. South Africa continued, you know, on the path of reconciliation, and Mandela could be presented as somebody who helped build the rainbow nation in South Africa. So this is my position on the South African issue.
Okay, I think I like the way you put it in the total perspective, bringing the, of course, the history of the relationship between Zulu and Xhosa, and you put it in the broader perspective in terms of how Botha had been treated. So now let me ask you this question. Do you think that Zuma was also aware of these dynamics And he knew that he could be defiant because ultimately things would work to his advantage because of the issue that you outlined.
Oh, yeah, of course. Zuma is he's a shrewd politician. And Zuma, I can say I've read a little bit about him. I studied Zuma. Zuma is he's a populist. He can use any narrative, anything for him, to get to where he wants to go. Let's see. When we was the vice president of Thabo Mbeki, and then there was that issue about money embezzlement, you know, about the arm deal. So what was he doing? Anytime he was going to court, not anytime, but some of the time he went to court, he was singing that song that people were singing during the struggle against apartheid. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if you know that song.
Yes, of course I know that song.
So you want to start the song then? Let me see if you know it.
That song, I think that song was banned.
No. So the song is what? In Shumane. Hey. So he used to sing that song, meaning like, give me your machine gun so that you can go and then kill the Boers. Do you understand?
Yes.
So he used to sing that song in order to mobilize people, you know, his supporters. So
you know, but it's ironic that when Julius Malema sang that same song, he got into trouble with the ANC, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So, but Zuma.
But continue the narrative. I just wanted to interject.
So Zuma was singing that. So this time he was rallying his supporters, and eventually, anyway, so he became president of South Africa. Mm. He knows that, and he uses that because when he became the leader of the ANC, he wanted. Like one of his former wives, who became the president of the African Union Commission, Miss Dr. Dlamini Zuma, to become the president of the ANC or to become the president of the country. And then against somebody like Cyril Ramaphosa, who, by the way, I believe comes from a small ethnic group called Venda. So you can imagine. Somebody coming from a small ethnic group Venda and another one coming from the Zulu, 22%. But even though the ANC is a multi-ethnic or multi-racial political party, the power of Thabo Mbeki, of Zuma was very strong. It was because Cyril Ramaphosa is like a great strategist. This is how he could take over the ANC and become the president of South Africa. But we knew that. Zuma was trying to find a way, to take his revenge. And I was talking to one of my young friends in South Africa. The reality is that people who support Zuma, they want to end the presidency of Cyril Ramaphosa. Uh-huh. And then, so that this is the reality. So if they could do an uprising. But unfortunately, or I won't say unfortunately, the way they did by looting, that was not the way. But there are some who were hoping to see like a popular uprising in South Africa because they cannot do a coup d'etat. They cannot do a successful coup d'etat. They wanted to use the street in order to end the presidency of Cyril Ramaphosa. So this is the tension.
So let me ask you that. Do you think that...
In the context of the COVID-19, there is hurting and then the economy and killing people and affecting the health system in South Africa.
Right.
So it is unfortunate for us to see such a spectacle coming from one of the greatest nations in Africa.
Okay, so now I want us to move away, but I think there are two other questions I still want to ask before we move to a different topic. And this is also, when you look at it, a struggle of the elite. This is the struggle of the bourgeoisie in South Africa. And other flip side of that whole question is the key issues of economic justice in South Africa remain completely unresolved at the end of the day. The white power structure and domination over the economy has been preserved. The land ownership has not been affected. where you have the minority European South Africans still owning over 70% of the land, although they make up less than 9% of the population. Now, to what extent are some of these outbursts of uprising that we are seeing also signs of disaffection over the fact that these key issues over economic justice have not been addressed?
Yeah, thank you, Milton. That's a very important question. We will talk about Cuba in a few, but it is the same thing. When people take to the streets in South Africa in order to express their anger because they think that injustice is done to Zuma, and then they take to the streets and they loot, they do everything that they're doing, or maybe hoping that they can put in danger or they can endanger the presidency of Cyril Ramaphosa. And you are right. Because when I went to South Africa, I have seen some great intellectuals, South Africans, expressing like so much anger against Nelson Mandela. Mm-hmm. I was shocked because I even though I can understand, the frustration, the anger, but I was surprised by the intensity of the anger that they had against Nelson Mandela.
Interesting. I think I know why, but go ahead. Tell me something.
As if he failed his people, as if he failed his mission. He was presented as somebody who was responsible for the economic state of South Africa, in which the whites who ruled South Africa using apartheid or racial segregation, who exploited South Africa, they still control the means of production and they still control the economy in South Africa. And blacks, the divide is becoming bigger and bigger. So
in other words, he should have negotiated for more, is what they're saying.
Yeah, but what I could not agree with them, and it's a good thing that we're having this conversation. I could not agree with them based on my observation and the things that I have read. Because guess what? From 1990, when Mandela came out of prison on February 11, 1990, April 27, 1994. There was he did not become president immediately after he came out of prison. It took him 4 years. And during those 4 years, and we saw a big tension between blacks on one side and whites on the other side. There were multiple tensions. And there was also a tension among blacks in South Africa. Among political parties, the Inkatha party led by the Buthelezi and the ANC led by Oliver Tambo or Nelson Mandela. And then there was bloodshed in South Africa. And then if people have the opportunity to watch two documentaries, South Africa Miracle Rising, and then Mandela, the struggle for freedom. It is like a 2 hour and 30 some minutes, the second one.
So are those on YouTube? Are they available on YouTube?
On YouTube. So when people watch those documentaries, you will see that Buthelezi, of the Inkatha Buthelezi, was in collusion with the National Party and with some insiders within the South African forces.
It was with the European Party is the National Party for the leader.
National Party. He was receiving fundings, and then the military, some military expert who were supporting him against the ANC. He was taking South Africa. He was not the only one, because Eugene Terblanche, the leader of the right wing, wanted to do a coup d'etat to take over. That was the condition in which Mandela was maneuvered to become the president of South Africa. And Buthelezi decided to boycott the election. So if black people in South Africa, if they were united by a common purpose, maybe Mandela could have done a better negotiation deal.
But
you will see the ANC fighting against Inkatha, Mandela fighting against the Inkatha, And there was another guy who was like was not a big, big leader, but he was ruling another Bantustan called Bopotswana, Lucas Mangope. Him, too, wanted to secede from the Union of South Africa. So that was the condition. And now Mandela definitely decided that he was going to have an alliance with the people were supporting Buthelezi. This is how the armed forces, the tanks of the South African army, controlled by what? The forces that entered the KwaZulu-Natal. This is when Buthelezi realized that he could not continue what he was doing. This is how he decided to go back to join the electoral process. And after the election, Mandela became the president. So, so that was something people need to take into account. And then today, if the European in South Africa, they manage, for instance, to try and take over or reduce the political ability of the ANC, because of what? Because Zuma and then Ramaphosa, they're fighting. And both of them are blacks, they're Africans, and they belong to the same political party, but for some reason, they cannot sit down and try and then demand their fences, and then they're exposing the differences, and then a European can come there and then try to take advantage and then again undermine the quest for black people, for self-determination. That's something that people need to take into account when they talk about the negotiation. But of course, I had the privilege to read a book written by William Gumede. The title is Thabo Mbeki and the Battle for the Soul of the ANC. In that book, there were some real, they put some real information about how Mandela did not negotiate well. So I take that into account. But the political climate was not very, very good. And people have to also look at that when they do the analysis.
I see. That's why it's helpful to have a professor like you, Lagoke, to break it down and give it that fuller perspective. Because it's so easy for people sitting on the fence or at a distance to just criticize Mandela without knowing the intricate details of what was really going on. The way you broke it down, it actually sounds like it was a miracle, whatever he achieved at that time.
Yeah,
but listeners, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM, also streaming on WBAI.org. And our guest today is Professor Naka Lagoke of Lincoln University. And we are discussing South Africa right now. We are moving to other topics momentarily. But listeners, as you know, WBAI is 100% listener supported. And that is how we can bring you the kind of conversation you're listening to right now. So I want to remind you, pick up the phone. Please dial 212-209-2950 and show us some love with your support so we can also continue to show you some love. Adopt one of our shows as well as a buddy, in which case the money is taken out of your credit or debit card on a monthly basis. And I hope Black Star News Show is one of the shows that you adopt. You can do that by going to give and then the number 2 and then WBI.org. Now back to Professor Lagoke. Okay, so thank you for that perspective on South Africa. Obviously, there's still a lot we could talk about in South Africa, but we will have you back on the show. Let's move on to another area now. Perhaps we can move up to Chad or Central African Republic, since we're taking this continental journey.
Yeah, so in Chad, I will not say that it is a... It's not like I don't want to talk about it as if it was simplistic. We know that Idriss Déby, that is his name, the president of Chad, was assassinated in some strange conditions.
Right.
And then when the rebels were hoping that they could seize the opportunity to chart, to impose a new course to Chad.
Right.
We saw the involvement of France that maneuvered to have the son of Idriss Déby become the leader of Chad. And then in the name of the fight against terrorism, as Idriss Déby was heavily involved in that struggle, France is using Chad in order to advance its neocolonial agenda and also to undermine the process of self-determination of the African people, particularly in so many of the countries like the Central African Republic. So, yes, so this is my perspective. I see if you have a specific question.
Yes, I do, actually. We are in 2021. These were the kind of issues that I thought would no longer happen after 1960s. What am I missing here?
Tell
listeners what we are missing. Why is it that in the 21st century, tiny, useless France, which would be a nothing country without the resources of Africa, is able to come and meddle in an African country like that and deny the people of Chad and whatever else France is meddling the right to decide their own destiny?
It's a very, very important question. People who are in English speaking countries that usually don't know, usually they don't have everything. They don't have all the details about what is happening in the Francophone world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, France was one of the major players in slavery, during slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And France was also a very important player during colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
And then when several generations of Africans, with the support of people of African descent, like W.B. Du Bois, George Padmore, Ras Makonnen, and many mm-hmm. others, and with internationalists, after the successful fight for the independence of Africa, when France realized that the wind of independence was taking over the continent of Africa, France decided to put into place a scheme in order to still control its colonies, which were about to become independent.
Mm-hmm.
Ghana became independent in 1957 under the leadership of Kwame Nkrumah.
Correct.
And then in 1958, under the leadership of General de Gaulle, who became the president of France, there was the new constitution called the Constitution of the Fifth Republic. And then according to that constitution, the French colonies were bound to France into a web of reciprocity. Then France was to put, the metropolis was supposed to be the head of the French Empire. And then in 1957, we saw the foundation of the European Economic Union, or Economic Community, and then right after the independence of African countries in 1960, then France put into place a number of commercial treaties and military agreements in order to still control its former colonies. We can talk about the Lomé agreements. Then the Cotonou Agreement, the Lomé Agreement, the Lomé Agreement that became later on the Cotonou Agreement. And then France played a major role in that. And then the resources, in the soils of those African countries, the leaders, they have the responsibility to trade with France, first with France. And if France does not want, then they can go and look elsewhere. So this is the conditions in which many African countries became independent. And then that monetary zone called the CFA franc, put into place in 1945, is still in force, even though they make some subsequent or gradual changes, but France is still controlling the monetary policies of those 14 African countries. Now, Sylvanus Olympio tried in 1963 to create his own currency. He was overthrown and assassinated. And then this is what happened. And then recently, we can talk about the crisis in Ivory Coast. Gbagbo, we know, despite his missteps and pitfalls and many of the mistakes that he made. He meant to free Ivory Coast, and he has his heart in the right place against the French neocolonial system. And we know what happened. The rebels in the Ivory Coast were trained and supported by France. Gbagbo was defeated militarily when he was believed to have lost the election in 2010. He was taken to The Hague, presented as the sole responsible of the crimes committed in the country. He was just freed after 10 years in custody. So this is the context. And then France used its former colonies and some other colonies in Asia and the world in order to increase its political clout on the international scene. When there was a crisis in Ivory Coast, the drafts, the resolutions at the United Nations were drafted, the resolution for Ivory Coast were drafted by the French representative, so that you can have an idea of what the condition in which the African countries that are Francophone, in which they are. So Nkrumah wrote that book when he spoke about neocolonialism, and France is the real embodiment of neocolonialism among all the European powers in Africa. France is really that power which is neocolonialist and which is doing everything possible in order to reduce the power for sovereignty of the African people. All those countries, I can talk about Ivory Coast. You take the telecommunication sector, it is in the hands of the French. You take the water sector in the hands of a French company. You take the electricity sector in the hands of the French. The publishing, you take many sectors of the society in the hands of the French companies. And so this is the fate of Africa. It is a tragedy. And then whoever will come to try and then to try and free himself, then is going to face either the wrath of the French or a rebellion or an assassination. Today, the president of the Central African Republic is facing the same thing. There was a rebellion there. The French were playing politics, and he had to rely on the Russian in order to try and then fight against the rebels. And then we're hearing rumors here and there. People are trying to try and then take him out of there, out of power, either by assassination or by another rebellion or by another coup d'etat. So this is the reality. Same thing is happening in Mali. Same thing is happening everywhere where the French are involved in the politics of the African nations.
All right. So listeners, we've reached the midpoint of the show. We take a break and we'll be back in a minute with our guest. again, Sisson and Brothers, welcome to the second half hour of Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York Radio. I am your host, Milton Alimadi. And today we have with us our guest, Professor Naka Lagoke of the Department of History, Political Science, and Philosophy at Lincoln University. We continue our conversation. So, Professor Lagoke, can we talk about some possible solutions? Do you see any hopeful signs anywhere? For example, recently, there were some protests in Senegal, and the young people were going after French interest, including French-dominated businesses, and were targeting that. Is that a sign that the young people are saying enough is enough?
Yeah, it's a sign that people are saying enough is enough. So in recent years, we saw, you know, several types of protests in like many African countries. We saw, for instance, that Malema in South Africa, who left the ANC, put into place the Economic Freedom Fighters in South Africa. And in Namibia, in Malawi, in Ghana, in some other parts, we can see that several other people are put together, like the Economic Freedom Fighters in their respective countries. That's one thing. In 2017, under the leadership of a youngster called Kemi Seba, there was a series of protests against the CFA franc. And then to the point that the French political elite, they were obliged to go and change the name of the CFA franc to ECO, which, by the way, was supposed to be the currency of the West, the economic community of the West African states. So that's another way, again, by France to go and try and undermine like a project, you know, to create a common currency for all the 16 countries in the West Africa. So we saw that. We also saw that in Burkina Faso in 2014, the people of Burkina Faso, they rose up, they organized, and then they ended the power of Blaise Compaoré, the very man who killed organized the killing of Thomas Sankara, his friend, to right. become the president of Burkina Faso, and then to be the puppet of French neo-colonialism. And then later on, we saw the People's Power Movement in Senegal in 2012. And then we saw that almost everywhere where people can, people organizing against the French. I've already mentioned a little bit the crisis in Ivory Coast. Even though Babou Laurent was not the greatest advocate of Pan-Africanism, his struggle and his resistance against France contributed, you know, to revive the Pan-African consciousness as, you know, the people understood that the French were beyond the rebellion, and the French openly went to bomb him on April 4th in 2011. So, we have in Uganda, Bobby Wine, who is standing against Museveni, who is the puppet of American imperialism. So you can see like there are in different parts of Africa, there is a wave of the Pan-African emotion. And now it is a very good thing because Pan-Africanism is back. Now, but the struggle needs to go to the next level. We need to have a coordination. And that's the thing that is lacking. When I was talking about people who are doing the right thing, I forgot to mention Professor Lumumba, like in Kenya. So all the people, now what people are doing, we can see it's a good thing. But we need to have the kind of coordination that people had when they were fighting for the independence of the African countries, or the kind of coordination they had when they were fighting against the apartheid system. I can recall that in 1958, under the leadership of Kwame Nkrumah, and there was the All Africa People's Conference, which was organized, and the chief architect was George Padmore. 100 are people gathered, among them Frantz Fanon, representing the Algerian Revolution, and then Patrice Lumumba, and many other people were there. This is how people organized the struggle. And 2 years later, 17 African countries became independent. But today, the difficulty that we have in the Pan-African struggle is that people want to do their own thing, and it is so difficult for us to have a coordination of the Pan-Africanist initiatives. And then, but we are getting there, and then we are trying, and eventually we will understand that that is the only way for us in order to survive in this world in which might is right. And then the European, even though each European country is individually strong, when they want to go and advance the neocolonial agenda, they don't go alone. France will go there with the entire European Union, with the support of the United Nations, Nations and the United States. So that's why our small groups cannot resist against the might of those institutions.
Yes, in fact, they were fighting amongst themselves. But when they wanted to host the Berlin conference,
yes,
they called a timeout.
Definitely.
And they met in Berlin in 1884 to 1885.
Thank you.
And stole the entire continent like gentlemen.
Yes,
at least during the duration of that meeting. So now, what you're saying is that there is need, urgent need, for another all African peoples conference. When are we going to have this? Who is going to be the host?
Oh, there are a couple of initiatives. I want to talk about that a little bit. There are a couple of things that happened in recent years. In Burkina Faso, there is an organization called Thomas Sankara Memorial, so because I am even a member of that organization, as people were working, to erect the Thomas Sankara Memorial, it is now public, it is there, people go to Burkina to see, to read about Sankara, it is important. We see our friends, Maurice Kani, director of the Friends of the Congo, with the noble and then the great struggle, for people to know what is happening in the Congo. So
right.
We see all those things. It is nice. From time to time, we meet. Also, there was a conference of my friend, Dr. Mjiba Freywot, who was here, and with whom we launched a series of conferences under the umbrella of the Revival of Pan-Africanist Forum. She's teaching the University of Legon in Ghana. And since she went there, with some other leaders, under the leadership of Dr. Horace Campbell, they organized the second cultural festival. I was there. Maurice Kani was there. There were more than 400 people who were there at that conference. It was a beautiful moment. But the difficulty that we have, we do not have the money. We don't have the resources, to do those things on a regular basis. But I recall that 1 year later, under the leadership of my friend, Dr. Mjiba Freywot, there was the 60th anniversary of the All-African People's Conference. Hundreds of people were there, and I was there at that conference too. So I was. So we trying, and some other people in different parts of the world are doing the same thing. But there was another conference, I think, organized by a group of people called Africa Today. It was organized in Winneba in September 2018. It was a major moment. 400 people were there at that conference. Unfortunately, despite all the money that they have, they could not make sure that the entire world knows about the event that they were putting together because the event was poorly publicized. So we need to come with a clear strategy. We have to coordinate our efforts. People have to try and sit around the table. We have to have the privilege to receive some funding from those who believe in the cause, for us to organize those type of events on a regular basis. Nkrumah, it was not just in 1958. In the same year, he organized the Conference of Independent African States. That was in April. In December, the All-Africa People's Conference. The following year, there was another All African People's Conference, and they organized different type of All African Women Conference, All African. So there were several organizations. Nkrumah could do that because he was in power.
Right.
But today, we have to try and do what we can do, but we have to do that in a coordinated way. And this is what I'm hoping for. And we do our part. And so I will talk about some of the things that we put together. You know, we launched our organization recently, a convention for Pan-Africanism and Progress, because we want to help in the coordination of all those initiatives in the continent of Africa and beyond.
Okay, so take a pause there. I just want to remind listeners that may be just tuning in right now that they're listening to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM New York Radio, and also streaming on WBI.org. Listeners, you hear this Pan-African conversation we're having with a true Pan-African, Pan-Africanist, very knowledgeable. And he's right. We need to have these meetings. We need to have an All African People's Conference and take on neocolonialism head to head. And that is the only way it can be done. And I think with social media, we can mobilize the funds needed to support such a conference. And you can only hear this type of conversation, need I remind you again, on WBAI, listeners. So do support us so we can continue to bring you this type of conversation. So I do remind you one more time before we close out. Pick up the phone and dial 212-209-2950. Show us some love. Or adopt one of our shows, including Black Star News Show, as a buddy. And the money is taken out of your credit or debit card on a monthly basis. You can do that by going to give and then the number 2 and WBI.org. Now back to Professor Naka Lagoke as we now close today's show. In the few minutes we have, Professor Lagoke, I would like you to touch a little bit on crisis in Haiti as well.
Oh, yeah. So Haiti, I don't know what I can say other that, you know, the president.
Well, not so much the details of the president being killed. Mm-hmm. So the media writes about that.
Yeah.
We want a more expansive perspective.
Yes. So,
and understanding of how similar their challenges are when you compare to the challenge in African countries.
Yeah, so be it Haiti or in Cuba or in Colombia, we know that the United States of America considered that part of the world as its backyard.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's the first thing that people have to understand. And then Haiti, after the successful revolt of slaves, inspired by the French Revolution of 1789, the Haitian Revolution 1791 to 1804, then the slaves could put into place a sovereign state. And then later on, Haiti felt the historical responsibility in order to help and then end slavery. But the Western powers did not want to acknowledge, you know, the sovereign state of Haiti, and then many other things were put into place in order to undermine, you know, the right to happiness of the Haitian people. So
correct.
From that time to today, you know, we don't have time to go into all those details.
Right.
We recall that in America. Recognized Haiti as an independent country in 1862 under the leadership of Abraham Lincoln. So Haiti has gone through like a series of crises, dictatorship supported by the United States and many other things. And then, of course, we know that America has some interest in controlling the political life of the Haitian, and by manipulating the electoral processes and by imposing and putting people that they can control who can serve and preserve the interests of American multinational or American interests. This is what we know until we heard about the assassination of the president. The prime minister is being accused. We know that those who were involved in the assassination of the president, many of them were trained by the United States in the name of the fight against drug, the fight against the terrorism, and also in the fight against pro-communist leaders like in the region. So this is what we know. Similar thing with Cuba that became the communist nation in 1959, and which was something that America could not support. The embargo that America put on Cuba today, people have seen now the effects. Even when you read the American newspapers, the Washington Post or New York Times, they acknowledge or they recognize that the American embargo is or blockade is having an impact on the economy of Cuba in the age of COVID-19.
Yeah, it's genocidal. That's what it is.
Yeah, even themselves, this is what they write. And at the same time, the people who are in the streets who may want to aspire to greater freedoms, which can be a legitimate aspiration, but why they don't protest or why they don't take to the street and then fight against the real cause of their own suffering, which is the blockade that America imposed on Cuba. So, this is my take on that issue.
I think that's a good wrap up. Now, before we run out of time, I want you to tell listeners about the platform that you helped to launch recently and the mission of that platform and how people can gain access. Is the website or?
Yeah, please. Thank you very much. Quickly, for those who were listening, Ali Madi Milton was introducing me as a teacher at professor at Lincoln University, but there's a portion in the name of the department that you forgot, which is the Pan-African Studies. So it's a long name, but Pan-African Studies is a part of it. And then we launched in 2007 the Revival of Pan-Africans Forum with Milton, Maurice Kane, Netfarm, Jiba, and then Omari Musa, many other friends, and Elder Beno. We organized a series of conferences. And then after the 60th anniversary of the All African People's Conference in Ghana, we decided to put together a new Pan-African organization, which is the Convention for Pan-Africans and Forum, CPP, and whose acronym is identical to the party that Nkrumah put into place.
Right.
Now, we have to know that Pan-Africanism has two major pillars, everything that is about Africa, and then the second pillar is internationalism. We organized the Cuba and Africa and the World Conferences in the Washington, D.C. area. But now, in the light of what is happening in the world, the Russian involvement to save the Central African Republic, the call of the Malians to the Russians, and then the involvement of China in the political life of Africa that gives the power of choice through the BRICS, which is an institution put into place by Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. We thought that we needed to put into place a new platform in the field of internationalism in order to talk about the quest for sovereignty of the nations in the world, and particularly the nations of Africa. So we are going to do the launching of that organization called the New Dawn Vision. And then on August 7, 2021, we will organize our first conference, and then we'll be organizing two conferences every month around the issues related, to the BRICS.
Okay, so is there a website that people can gain more information about?
We're putting together the website, but the Facebook will be the New Dawn Vision on Facebook.
Okay, New Dawn Vision, that's already on Facebook, correct?
Yes, on the Facebook, yes.
Okay, very good. We've literally run out of time. I want you to give listeners your contact information in case somebody wants to continue conversation with you. Is there a good email address to reach you?
My email is nyakalagoke@gmail.com. GNAKALAGOKE at gmail.com.
Thank you so much, comrade. That's all the time we have. Listeners, you can also follow me at Ali Mahdi on Twitter. Remember to go to blackstarnews.com as well. We'll
Thank
have you,
very much, brother.
Back very soon. Professor Naka Lagoke, thank you so much for your time.
With the WBAI Community Bulletin Board. Each night at 7 p.m. at McCarran Park, there is a gathering in support of Black Lives and the Black Lives Matter movement. This is a 100% community-led nightly gathering. For more information, go to McCarran Gathering on Instagram. That's MCCAREN Gathering on Instagram. On July 27th at 11 a.m., join the Gangs Coalition for the Erase the Database rally. Join families, legal orgs, and advocates outside the Inspector General's office to reignite their demand for a probe of NYPD gang policing tactics, including the gang database. For more information, go to Gangs Coalition on Twitter. That's Gangs Coalition on Twitter. On July 27th at 4:30, several U.S. groups will hold a peaceful protest to defund Zionist settler groups. This protest will be held at 55 Hanson Plaza in Brooklyn. For more information, visit New York for Palestine on Facebook. That's NY4 Palestine on Facebook. On July 29th, join 34th Street for free dance classes in Midtown. Every Thursday evening through August 31st, enjoy a free outdoor salsa class. Each week, participants will learn from the city's top salsa instructors, then show off their moves on the dance floor with a full hour of social dancing. For more information and to register for this free event, check out the Midtown Dance Classes on Eventbrite. That's Midtown Dance Classes on Eventbrite. On Friday, July 30th, join 100 Men Rising for a rally to raise visibility on violence towards women and femmes. Gather to hear stories, build relationships, and continue a commitment to ending violence towards all women and femmes in this lifetime. For more information, look for the 100 Men Rising rally on Eventbrite. That's 100 Men Rising rally on Eventbrite. On Saturday, July 31st, from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m., join Christopher Street Tours for LGBTQ History Walking Tour through Greenwich Village. On this tour, you will visit historic sites where revolutions began, riots were sparked, and history was made, including the famous Stonewall Inn. Tickets are $35, but are free for LGBTQ youth under 18 years of age. For more information, visit ChristopherStreetsTours.com. That's ChristopherStreetsTours.com. On August 4th, from 6 to 8 p.m., join Senator Robert Jackson and Palante Harlem, that's P-A-L-A-N-T-E Harlem, for a rent relief clinic. Get support applying for the Emergency Rental Assistance Program that can help with up to 12 months of rent and utility arrears. For more information, visit Senator Robert Jackson on Twitter. That's the Twitter page for Senator Robert Jackson. If you have events for our community board, email us at radio@wbai.org. I'm Angela Palumbo for the WBAI Community Bulletin Board.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Amara Evering with some brief news headlines. The first hearing of the special House committee investigating the January 6 attack has concluded for the day. Four police officers in the trial described their experience with physical and verbal abuse during the insurrection. A new video was introduced showing one of the officers, Michael Fanone, being dragged out of the Capitol and beaten by insurrectionists. He testified that some were trying to reach for his gun, and he heard someone shout in the crowd, quote, "Kill him with his own gun." Fanon pleaded with them, saying, quote, "I have kids." U.S. Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn recalled how some people shouted the N-word at him. The committee's chairman, Representative Benny Thompson, commented, quote, "Some people are trying to deny what happened, to whitewash it, to turn the insurrectionists into martyrs. But the whole world saw the reality of what happened on January 6th. This is Sergeant Gunnell, who was present during the riot, speaking about this.
You hear former President Trump say, quote, "It was a loving crowd. There was a lot of love in the crowd." How does that make you feel?
It's upsetting. It's a pathetic excuse for his behavior.